Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. The last week has brought two major stories, President Jimmy Carter's funeral and the devastating wildfires in the LA area. I'm sure you've heard updates on that. Vanity Fair is bringing stories about how it is impacting the people, the art world, and award season. So this first article was published by Nate Freeman on January 9th. It's almost like Noah's Ark. Jeff Klein's Sunset Tower is housing wildfire refugees and their pets. Just days ago in Los Angeles, the Sunset Tower was hosting Golden Globe soirees at the Tower Bar downstairs, as well as nominees squeezing into their ceremony-ready ball gowns and tuxes in the suites upstairs, the City of Angels looming gloriously behind them. That seems like a distant memory after 3 days when unrelenting wildfires tore through the Pacific Palisades and Altadena, the two worst fires in the history of Los Angeles, happening simultaneously, burning through thousands of acres of land and destroying buildings, businesses, and cultural landmarks. Numerous people have lost their homes and at least 5 residents have died. The restaurants that hosted the starriest Golden Globe parties, Disney at Funk, Universal at Lavo, are closed for the time being. But in order to accommodate local evacuees, the Sunset Tower Hotel, one of the great West Hollywood Art Deco haunts, with its beloved Tinseltown canteen and tower bar, has stayed open. It's currently giving shelter to those who have either lost their homes or been asked to evacuate. Owner Jeff Klein has been on the ground each night, hanging with Tower Bar regulars who have taken up residence in the hotel for what is decidedly not a staycation, and the hotelier has been trying to give comfort to those who could lose everything. The Sunset Tower will always be glamorous, but right now it's putting a roof over the heads of those who have faced disaster. It's undeniable that there's stress. People have lost their homes, lost personal belongings. There was a woman I was talking to last night in the Tower Bar who was staying in the hotel. She took her jewelry, but she forgot to take letters that her mother, who is no longer with us, wrote her, Klein told me by phone from LA on Thursday. Hopefully what we're able to provide is a quick escape from the stresses and anxieties that they're going through by providing hospitality and a cool place and a nice drink and some live music and whatnot to really just kind of alleviate all the stress, he went on. For an hour or two, they can come downstairs to the lobby bar or to the tower bar and have dinner, but it still doesn't take away from all that's going on. It's a scene that's playing out across the city's favorite haunts. The Los Angeles Times sent a reporter to the Beverly Hills Hotel to check out the luxe vibes, and TMZ is reporting that there's no room at the Peninsula, the Waldorf Astoria, or the Four Seasons. Klein, who also runs the No Photos Allowed Members Club at San Vicente Bungalows, wouldn't name names, but during non-disaster times, regulars at the Sunset Tower Hotel have included those at the tippy top of the worlds of film, fashion, media, and art. Think Tom Ford, Bill Murray, Mick Jagger, Jeff Koons, Brian Lord, and Jennifer Aniston. And everyone wants to experience a shred of normalcy at a time when, if you look outside or look at your phone, all you see is fire and ash. It's nice to know that something that makes you happy, you can come back to, and it's still there and it's still standing, Klein said. And it's the same piano and bass player and same stiff cocktails and the same vibe and energy and the wood panel walls and the glow of the lights. I think it's just nice when other things have been taken away from us. And while most Sunset Tower guests don't usually bring their golden doodles, the life-or-death nature of these stays has effectively turned the hotel into a petting zoo. There's a lot more pets, and that makes me happy because, unfortunately, there was an article in the New York Times today about how people are leaving their pets behind in the fires, he said. So I'm happy to know that at least the Sunset Tower, they're bringing their pets. It's also nice. I think a pet will comfort you as well. But yes, it's almost like Noah's Ark in a way. Klein's Hotel, where the Vanity Fair Oscar party was held for several years starting in 2009, faced the threat of apocalyptic flames itself on Wednesday night when the Sunset Fire broke out in the Hollywood Hills, causing authorities to issue evacuation orders to canyon dwellers. The Sunset Tower was just outside the warning zone, and when guests saw the fire area expanding from 10 to 50 acres, they started wondering if they should pack it in too. The Hollywood fire was very scary. It was very close to the Sunset Tower, and actually we were wondering if we should evacuate ourselves last night, Klein said. But I called the fire chief and he said, I don't think you need to. The Sunset Fire was contained by midday Thursday thanks to efforts by first responders, and residents were already returning to their homes that morning. Incredibly, despite the flames engulfing the Hollywood Hills Wednesday night, reports indicate that not a single home in the area was destroyed, a silver lining in the face of the terrifying losses in Altadena and the Pacific Palisades. All one can do is hope that the efforts to slow the spread of the large fires will succeed before the winds pick up again, and until then, there will be live jazz performed nightly at the Tower Bar. I think the worst is behind us, Klein said. We'll wait and see. This next article is a developing story published on January 9th by Savannah Walsh, Inside the Pacific Palisades, Where Fires Are Halting Hollywood. Several wildfires currently rage across northern Los Angeles, including one in the celebrity-filled Pacific Palisades area, where more than 15,000 acres have been ravaged. Since Tuesday morning, the LA fires have claimed at least two lives and destroyed hundreds of homes and businesses, displacing more than 30,000 residents who have been forced to evacuate during the city's state of emergency. Given the location of this tragedy, Hollywood has also been thrown into turmoil. Filming has been suspended in the area, as have major award season events. Residents like Ben Affleck have reportedly evacuated their homes. Reese Witherspoon, who bought a house in the Pacific Palisades in 2023, wrote on her Instagram stories, praying for all the firefighters, first responders, and families who are near these fires in LA. Several celebrities have documented the fire's effect on their lives. Others who have not spoken publicly have reportedly lost their homes, including Anna Faris, as well as Adam Brody and Leighton Meester, and reality stars Spencer Pratt and Heidi Montag Pratt. The locus of the damage is the Pacific Palisades, a coastal neighborhood located 20 miles west of downtown. The area has become a celebrity destination for its central location, as well as its small-town feel. Plus, there's the relative privacy. From a shopping perspective, we rarely have paparazzi, unlike on Robertson. Fashion designer Elise Walker, who has a Pacific Palisades boutique, told The Hollywood Reporter in 2012, it's very much under the radar. The Oppenheim Group, the real estate hub central to Netflix's Selling Sunset, credits some of the area's popularity to highly rated public schools and proximity to the exclusive Riviera Country Club, which is set to host the PGA Tour next month. That makes one of the wildfire's casualties even more devastating. The conflagration has destroyed Palisades Charter High School, a popular filming spot for movies like the 1976 horror classic Carrie, 2003's Freaky Friday starring Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan, and the Teen Wolf TV series. According to NBC Los Angeles, fires spread throughout the Pali campus, which has been closed to students and staff, as well as the adjacent Theater Palisades. Notable celebrity alumni who have attended the school include Oscar winner Forrest Whitaker, Power producer J.J. Abrams, Emmy winner Katie Sagal, and Black Eyed Peas member Will.i.am, Sarah Foster, an executive producer on Netflix's Nobody Wants This, wrote on her Instagram story, alongside footage of the wildfires, Pali High School is on fire, an incredible public school that kids from all over come to. I grew up going there. This is unreal. A-listers have also historically flocked to the Palisades area for its gorgeous, unobstructed views of the surrounding Santa Monica Mountains and the Pacific Ocean below, according to Josh Flagg, a real estate broker on Bravo's million-dollar listing Los Angeles. Per his website, the average price per square foot for properties in the area rose by 32% to $1,215 over the past year, with a median sales price of $2,385,000. And its appeal is not new. When Steven Spielberg purchased a Palisades home, once owned by David O. Selznick and Cary Grant, the history of the house attracted me instinctively, he told Architectural Digest back in 1989. It was important for me to know that David Selznick had lived there during the time he had produced Gone with the Wind. also top of mind for the Oscar winner, the view was from Los Angeles International Airport all the way to Malibu. On the left of it was flanked by beautiful trees. On the right, it was flanked by Will Rogers State Park, which was the most attractive thing about the site, said Spielberg. I knew they could never destroy the park with homes. It was like going to Hawaii and finding the perfect cove. Now the area has been demolished by flames, which have frozen the industry as well as destroying homes. Film LA, the agency that oversees production in Los Angeles, released a statement announcing that the LA County Fire Department has withdrawn all permits issued for filming in the areas of Altadena, La Crescenta, La Cañada, and unincorporated Pasadena. Personnel resources ordinarily available to support film production may not be available during the local state of emergency, the statement said. Some of the productions put on pause include Grey's Anatomy, Hacks, Suits LA, NCIS, Loot, Ted, and Happy's Place, as reported by Variety. Live tapings of programs such as Jimmy Kimmel Live and After Midnight have also been suspended as the fires rage on. Nominations for the SAG Awards, a key precursor event to the Oscars, were intended to be announced live from LA by Cooper Koch and Joey King on Wednesday morning, but instead got delivered via press release as a safety measure. Other award season events have been thrown into flux, including the AFI Awards, BAFTA Tea Party, and the Critics' Choice Awards, which were set to commence in Santa Monica just miles from the Pacific Palisades on Sunday and air live on E! The show has been postponed until January 26th, according to The Hollywood Reporter. Additionally, premieres across Los Angeles have been delayed or canceled. Jennifer Lopez's sports drama, Unstoppable, Julia Garner's horror film, Wolfman, and Pamela Anderson's SAG-nominated The Last Showgirl are among the debuts that have been impacted. And once again, this is a developing news story. Our next headline, Donald Trump responds to the LA wildfire catastrophe the only way he knows how. As more than 100,000 people have fled the destructive blaze, the incoming president exploited the tragedy to attack California Governor Gavin Newsom and other Democrats. This is by Eric Lutz, published on January 9th. The wildfires ravaging Los Angeles have killed at least five, forced the evacuation of more than 100,000 people, and reduced entire neighborhoods to rubble. The Palisades blaze, which continues to burn mostly uncontrolled, is already the most destructive in the city's history, and a new round of Santa Ana winds threatens to make the situation even worse. It is a still unfolding tragedy on what residents have described as an apocalyptic scale. But to Donald Trump, it is apparently also an opportunity to score political points. As Southern California burns, the incoming president has repeatedly attacked the state's governor, Gavin Newsom, writing in a series of social media posts that he and other Democrats are at fault for the national disaster. He is the blame for this, Trump posted. Gavin Newsom should resign. It's a mistake of the governor, Trump added to the reporters, as the infernos raged across Los Angeles. I guess it looks like we're going to be the one having to rebuild it. Nobody has ever seen such failed numbers before, Trump continued Thursday morning before he attended Jimmy Carter's funeral in Washington. Gross incompetence by Gavin Newsom and Karen Bass, he said, referring to the Democratic mayor of Los Angeles who has faced local criticism for being in Ghana at the time of the fires. LA is a total wipeout. The president-elect's allies, including Elon Musk, have joined in the pile-on. DEI means people, D-I-E, the billionaire, Trump advisor wrote on the influential social media platform he owns, bizarrely and baselessly, blaming the catastrophe on diversity politics. The MAGA attacks on Democrats have been shameless and filled with flagrant lies, including Trump's suggestion that FEMA money to aid Los Angeles has instead been spent by Joe Biden on the Green New scam, referring to the Green New Deal that was never actually enacted. People are literally fleeing, Newsom said in response to Trump's criticism during an appearance on CNN. People have lost their lives. Kids lost their schools, families completely torn asunder, churches burned down. This guy wants to politicize it. This, of course, is Trump's standard response to crises. We saw it on full display during Hurricane Helene last fall, and more recently following the deadly truck attack on New Orleans. In both instances, he spread dangerous falsehoods that not only exploited Americans' suffering for political gain, but complicated efforts to deal with those tragedies. Now he's doing it once again, using a calamity as grist for his long-running feud with the blue state leader and frequent critic. "I have a lot of thoughts about what I want to say," Newsom told CNN Wednesday, "and I won't." Moving to the next top news story of the week, Jimmy Carter's funeral, this first headline. Barack Obama and Donald Trump looked unsettlingly friendly at Jimmy Carter's state funeral. This is by Casey Wickman, published on January 9th. One minute, President Barack Obama is calling President-elect Donald Trump loopily old, saying, "If your grandpa was acting like this, you'd be worried," referring to him as a fucking lunatic, and taking the stage to diss him at the Democratic National Convention. The next minute, he appears to be laughing at the guy's jokes and engaging in cordial conversation with the once and future President Trump. Obama and Trump were seated next to one another at Thursday's state funeral for former President Jimmy Carter, who died in hospice on December 29, 2024, at 100 years old. All five living former presidents, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and current President Joe Biden, in addition to Trump and Obama, were in attendance at Washington National Cathedral to pay their respects. Though these functions typically have a boy-girl-boy-girl seating chart, Michelle Obama was unable to attend the service, meaning that while Melania Trump sat on the outer aisle of the row, Barack and Donald were right next to each other, no spouse buffer in sight. Asked about her absence, a spokesperson for Michelle Obama told Vanity Fair, "Former First Lady Michelle Obama is not in attendance at President Carter's national funeral service. Mrs. Obama sends her thoughts and prayers to the Carter family and everyone who loved and learned from the remarkable former president." With the exception of Obama, all the former president's spouses attended the service with them. Former Trump Vice President Mike Pence and wife Karen Pence were also at the service, marking the first time Pence and Trump have publicly met since the January 6th riots, as were Trump's 2024 opponent, Vice President Kamala Harris, and her husband Doug Emhoff. Given the history and years of past barbs traded between the pair, Trump originated the birther myth and claimed that Obama wasn't qualified to lead the country. Obama called Trump a racist, sexist pig. It wouldn't be so surprising to see the two sit side by side in stoic silence. Instead, they appeared to have a cordial chat, even sharing a laugh. Harris sat in the row in front of the pair, staring straight ahead. When Bush, whose wife Laura Bush, sat between her husband and Obama, headed to his chair, he ignored the Trumps completely and greeted Obama with a friendly swat as he passed his successor. One social media user likened Obama to a parent entertaining a child, or they get cranky and may even whine, while another pointed to the interaction as evidence of how unserious Democrats are. Oklahoma Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen interpreted it as Obama kissing the ring because Trump is the most popular man in the world. "Sir, please share your sources and whatever you took that's fueling such a flight of fancy." Of course, we have no way of knowing what the two actually said. It could easily have been a laughing at situation rather than laughing with, and there's plenty that can be said through clenched teeth shaped into a camera-ready smile. Try it. You don't even have to part your teeth to tell someone to go to hell if you put your mind to it. Carter, who will be buried in his Georgia hometown in a private service Thursday afternoon, voted in his last presidential election in 2024, casting his vote via an absentee ballot for Harris. His family told the press that while in hospice, Carter said he was only trying to make it to vote for Kamala Harris. Representatives for Barack Obama and Donald Trump did not immediately respond to Vanity Fair's request for comment. Our next headline, Prince Edward represented the royal family at Jimmy Carter's funeral. What does that mean for Trump? This is by Aaron Vanderhoof, published on January 10th. As King Charles III continued his holiday break on the Balmoral estate and Prince William celebrated wife Kate Middleton's 43rd birthday, Prince Edward, Duke of Edinburgh, took on his older brother's mantle and represented the Windsors at the state funeral for President Jimmy Carter on Thursday. Carter, who died at the age of 100 on December 29th, was honored with a service at the Washington National Cathedral. The Duke was seated in the second row next to Canada's Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, right behind the reunion of the five living former presidents that made the headlines. Edward traveled alongside Gordon Brown, UK's Prime Minister and leader of the Labour Party from 2007 to 2010. Soon after Carter's death, Brown wrote that he counted the former president and his wife, Rosalind, as friends in a Guardian op-ed. After the funeral, the Duke was spotted speaking with both President Joe Biden and greeting once and future President Donald Trump. King Charles expressed his condolences and remembered his one meeting with Carter in a statement released soon after his death, saying, "It is with great sadness that I learned of the death of former President Carter," the King wrote. "He was a committed public servant and devoted his life to promoting peace and human rights. His dedication to humility served as an inspiration to many, and I remember with great fondness his visit to the United Kingdom in 1977. The state funeral marked the second major meeting between Trump and the British royals since the November 5th election, following his brief sit-down with Prince William after a service for the reopening of Paris's Notre Dame Cathedral. Afterwards, Trump shared details about his conversation with the New York Post, adding some effusive praise for William's brand new beard. According to royal historian Ed Owens, author of After Elizabeth, Can the Monarchy Save Itself?, Edward's presence at the funeral was a sign that the royals will be an increasingly useful tool for diplomacy between the U.S. and the U.K. during a second Trump administration. U.K. Prime Minister Keir Starmer and Donald Trump don't see eye to eye on everything, or at least they're not going to see eye to eye on everything, Owens told CNN. The fact that Trump is deferential to the British royal family, impressed by them, I think that bodes well for the UK, if the UK can use the royals strategically. Edward's appearance at the funeral was a reflection of the Duke's continued importance to the monarchy as the lineup of working royals gets smaller. In 2024, Edward and his wife Sophie, Duchess of Edinburgh, were the family's most consistent working royals in a year when King Charles and Princess Kate were both diagnosed with cancer, and Princess Anne, usually the busiest member of the family, was sidelined after sustaining a minor head injury from a horse in June. In October, Sophie made an official visit to Ukraine, and in December, Edward made one to Kuwait. Their daughter, Lady Louise Windsor, is a third-year student at the University of St. Andrews, and in December, their son, James, Earl of Wessex, celebrated his 17th birthday. James still lives with his parents at Bagshot Park, their Surrey home, a short drive away from Windsor Home Park, where William and Kate live in the shadow of the historic castle. On January 20th, Sophie will celebrate her 60th birthday, and a royal source told Vanity Fair that the palace plans to release a photo of the Duchess, but any further celebrations will be low-key by request. In other royal news, Meghan Markle mourns the loss of her beloved pup. She rescued the dog from a Kentucky mill in 2015 and in a tear-jerking post for any pet lover says he'll have lots of cameos in With Love, Meghan. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof on January 7th. Less than a week after Meghan Markle launched her new Instagram account, she used it to share news about a recent loss. On Tuesday, she announced the death of Guy, the rescue beagle she's owned for nearly a decade, in a long caption. "Thank you for so many years of unconditional love, my sweet Guy," she wrote. "You filled my life in ways you'll never know." Alongside a video that showed Guy at various stages in his life, she explained how she came to own the dog. "In 2015, I adopted a beagle from a dog rescue in Canada. He had been at a kill shelter in Kentucky and given a few days to live. I swooped him up and fell in love," she wrote. "They referred to him as the little guy because he was so small and frail, so I named him Guy. And he was the best guy any girl could have asked for. If you followed me on Instagram back in the day, you saw a lot of him, and on the Tig, too. He was with me at Suits, when I got engaged, and then married. When I became a mom, he was with me for everything. The quiet, the chaos, the calm, the comfort." Meghan added that Guy was injured in an accident months before she made her move to the UK, thanking the veterinarian who cared for him while she and Harry were living in Surrey. She also thanked the vets who cared for him in Toronto and the ones who cared for him recently. She said that the upcoming premiere of her show, With Love, Megan, on January 15th, influenced her decision to share the news publicly. Because many of you will now see Guy in this new series, I hope you'll come to understand why I'm so devastated by his loss. I think you may fall in love a little bit, too. She said, I've cried too many tears to count, the type of tears that make you get in the shower with the absurd hope that the running water on your face will somehow make you not feel them or pretend they're not there. But they are, and that's okay, too. And Prince William calls Kate Middleton the most incredible wife and mother on her 43rd birthday. This is by Katie Nichol on January 9th. After a challenging year, Prince William has shared a moving tribute to his wife, Kate Middleton, on her 43rd birthday, describing her as the most incredible wife and mother alongside a new portrait. To the most incredible wife and mother, the strength you've shown over the last year has been remarkable, wrote in a post shared to Instagram and X on Thursday. George, Charlotte, Louis, and I are so proud of you. Happy birthday, Catherine. We love you. W. The new black and white portrait of the Princess of Wales was taken by photographer Matt Porteous last summer, according to the palace. In the image, Kate wears jeans, a white t-shirt, a blazer, and a checkered scarf. At press time, it has 800,000 likes and thousands of comments from well-wishers. King Charles and Queen Camilla also offered their birthday wishes with an Instagram story of Kate collecting flowers during the royal family's Christmas Day walk in Sandringham last month. As for how Kate will commemorate the special day, a source close to the princess tells Vanity Fair that she will be spending her birthday with Prince William at Windsor. When the couple's children, Prince George, Princess Charlotte, and Prince Louis, return from school, the family will have a birthday celebration. A homemade cake is likely to be part of the festivities, as Princess Kate loves to bake with her children. Catherine isn't one for big celebrations, and after the year she has had, she is simply grateful to be with her family, says a friend. She will spend the day with William and then gather with her family later on today. Sources close to the Princess of Wales say she is looking forward to the year ahead, following a turbulent 2024. Last year, Kate turned 42 shortly before Kensington Palace announced that she had undergone major abdominal surgery. Several weeks later, the princess revealed that she had been diagnosed with cancer in a video message and would undergo preventative chemotherapy, which she completed at the end of the summer. While she has said she's not yet out of the woods, Princess Kate is currently cancer-free, fit and well, and palace sources say she's looking forward to a gradual return to work over the coming months. It's not like there's going to be a major reset button. More, this will be a continuation of her gradual return to work, the royal source says. In June, Kate returned to official duties after 6 months out of the public eye when she attended Trooping the Colour in June and Wimbledon in July. She was also at the Cenotaph in November for Remembrance Sunday commemorations, and just before Christmas, Kate hosted her Together at Christmas Carol service, which palace sources say was a real highlight for the royals at the end of a difficult year. We will see the princess gradually return to work. Her early years work will continue to be a key focus as she returns back to more public-facing engagements over the coming months, the royal source says. The princess is determined to carry on where she left off in terms of duties and engagements. However, her cancer diagnosis has made her reassess her priorities, according to those close to her. While her children have always been her number one priority, staying healthy and cancer-free is also her focus today. It'll also be an important year for Prince George, who will start secondary school in September. William and Kate have been looking at several possibilities for George, including independent, single-sex, and co-ed schools. The princess has been seen quietly visiting several North London schools, which suggests that George may not attend Eton like his father. Sources close to the couple say there are lots of talks going on at present, but the pair have not yet made a decision about where George will go to school and are keeping all their options open. I'm going to pause to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We're currently reading from vanityfair.com. We're headed to the Hive section. Our first headline, TikTok's fate is in the Supreme Court's hand. This is by Christian Farias, published on January 9th. Its name is a mouthful, but no one who stops to read the text of the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act, which Congress and President Joe Biden codified as law last year, can have any doubts that its purpose was to give TikTok and its foreign owners an ultimatum. Sell the wildly popular app to a U.S.-based company or cease operations in the country by a certain date. Can the government do that? That the date happens to be the last full day of the sitting president's term is the cherry on top, as if the political branches decided that the stakes of keeping the U.S. version of TikTok under the control of the Chinese government were too high to leave to the whims of the electorate. There was prescience to that legislative choice, because now that Donald Trump is the president-elect and the new Congress has made it clear that he cannot have one big, beautiful bill to fund his tax cuts and an expansion of the deportation machine he'd like to set in motion, there's simply no telling how the incoming commander-in-chief plans to deal with the bipartisan consensus that TikTok's days are numbered, unless and until the People's Republic of China gives it up to a suitable bidder. That won't be happening. China has reportedly all but chosen a U.S. shutdown if all else fails. The so-called TikTok ban, which goes into effect in 10 days, is now in the hands of the conservative majority Supreme Court, which has its own history of moving whichever way the wind blows. Right before the holidays, the justice agreed to fast-track a last-ditch effort by TikTok and Chinese-controlled tech giant ByteDance, plus a group of content creators, to put a freeze on the divestment or banishment law. Their main and only argument is that the First Amendment to the Constitution stands in the way of the U.S. government shutting down a platform that some 170 million users rely on for disseminating and consuming news, entertainment, culture, and so much more. Congress shall make no law abridging the sharing of these things, they say. Or can it? The past, present, and future solicitors general of the United States, the title given to the government's top Supreme Court lawyer, all have different conceptions of this question and how the case should shake out. For their part, TikTok and ByteDance turned to Noel Francisco, Trump's former solicitor general and a key defender of everything from his Muslim-targeted travel ban to the failed attempts to kill the Affordable Care Act and protections for Dreamers. In Francisco and his team's view, Congress is silencing a speech platform used by half the country, and thus its ban must be subject to the highest form of judicial scrutiny, the kind that almost no government action can survive. To make this case, the company more or less argues that it should be treated like an American publisher making editorial choices, and that is powerful algorithm, the one that determines the dance videos or TikTok challenges that appear in a user's feed, is akin to a newspaper deciding on the articles to put in front of readers. If the Washington Post used an algorithm to email its subscribers op-eds based exclusively on predicted subscriber preferences, that would be an editorial choice, a decision to target readers with content they likely want rather than what editors think they should read, Francisco writes in a legal brief. The First Amendment fully protects such editorial choices. TikTok must really like the Post analogy, if not the paper's place in the national discourse, because later on in the same brief, Francisco floats a hypothetical in which Congress tries to make Jeff Bezos sell the newspaper because lawmakers feel that the breadth of his transnational business entanglements might lead foreign adversaries to pressure him to steer the journalism in ways favorable to them. That law would obviously burden his First Amendment rights, Francisco adds. The current Solicitor General, Elizabeth Preligar, who will be out of a job by noon on Inauguration Day, will get one last chance to make an impression about where the power lies. Her brief, like others from her tenure, presents a maximalist view of Congress and the President's prerogative to safeguard national security. And an order to divest in this realm has nothing to do with the First Amendment. Congress and the executive branch determined that ByteDance's ownership and control of TikTok pose an unacceptable threat to national security, she writes, because that relationship could permit a foreign adversary government to collect intelligence on and manipulate the content received by TikTok's American users, even if those harms had not yet materialized. The government's two rationales for the legislation, the threat of data mining and spying by a foreign adversary, and the potential manipulation of content in ways that could sway U.S. users, are not merely academic. That TikTok isn't allowed in China, of all places, is potent evidence that ByteDance is well aware of the app's power to persuade people with content that only ByteDance's closely guarded algorithm knows how to curate. That is, ByteDance demands freedom of expression here, but not at home. The company does operate a TikTok-like alternative, Douyin, in China. As the U.S. welcomes a new presidential administration that is already floating a new world order, it's not hard to imagine a future in which China leans on TikTok to protect its interests here and abroad. Here's where Trump's pick for Solicitor General comes in. John Sauer, best known for securing the Supreme Court's history-shattering presidential immunity ruling on behalf of his client, is expected to take over from Prelogar come January 20th, or later if he decides to remain in private practice until his Senate confirmation. Without being asked by the court, he submitted a brief that takes no position on how the justices should rule, but nonetheless bloviates about how only Trump can make sure everyone is happy. President Trump alone possesses the consummate deal-making expertise, the electoral mandate, and the political will to negotiate a resolution to save the platform while addressing the national security concerns expressed by the government, he writes. Trump himself already took steps back in 2020 to rein in TikTok, as Sauer notes, only to change his mind 4 years later because this sucker might have helped him regain the presidency. Yet others remain steadfast in their opposition, from the Federal Trade Commission and Mitch McConnell to a number of states, including some led by members of Trump's own party. Many continue to view the app as a threat to people's privacy and children's safety. What can Trump do once in office that many others already haven't tried to keep TikTok in check? Sauer doesn't say. He only notes that the incoming president should be allowed to bring about a political resolution, never mind the political resolution that a bipartisan Congress and Biden already reached. Worse still, Sauer may be undermining his client's position, if not his own credibility as a future Solicitor General, with yet another complication. His desperate attempt to put a stop to the criminal sentencing that Trump is expected to face in New York on Friday over his felony conviction related to a hush money payment to Stormy Daniels. And if Trump doesn't get his way in the lower court, Sauer may yet file another emergency request to try to prevent Jack Smith's special counsel report on January 6 from becoming public. With the Supreme Court already racing to decide TikTok's fate on an expedited basis, and the blowback to John Roberts' immunity ruling not far in the rearview mirror, one wonders whether there's any appetite to once again keep Trump from even a modicum of legal consequence. As things stand now, Judge Juan Merchan remains committed to imposing no more than a slap on the wrist. And then there's Justice Samuel Alito, who went on the record Wednesday to confirm that he and Trump had a conversation, a humdrum job recommendation for a former clerk, according to the justice, just days before he and his colleagues would rule on TikTok and the president-elect's fortunes. Unforced error or not, those are the kinds of moves that fuel the sentiment that the Supreme Court can't do things by the book. With so much on the line for the millions who will be watching the court in the coming days, to say nothing of everyone else embracing for the next 4 years, the High Court cannot afford to go any lower than it already has. Our next headline, Donald Trump's Imperial State of Mind. This is by Eric Lutz, published on January 8th. How are we supposed to take Donald Trump's words? Seriously? Not literally? Symbolically? As an endless stream of bullshit and distraction? Or as concepts of plans, trial balloons, and trolling. Parsing what the soon-to-be president is actually talking about is troublesome enough, but it gets even messier when, say, he starts suggesting that, in that offhanded but not exactly improvised way of his, that he might be open to taking the autonomous Danish territory of Greenland by force. In a press conference Monday, Trump, who ran as a foreign policy dove on the promise of not starting any wars, raised the prospect of using the United States military to annex the Arctic island, as well as the Panama Canal. "You might have to do something," he said, the same day his son, Donald Trump Jr., arrived in Greenland on Tuesday with a message for his people. "We're going to treat you well. The president-elect, posting later, said that this is a deal that must happen, and then all in caps, make Greenland great again. Trump, who fashioned himself something of an America First isolationist in his first term and his successful 2024 campaign, hasn't only set his sights on Greenland and the Panama Canal, he's also repeatedly joked about making Canada the 51st American state and demoting outgoing Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to governor. Some of this is surely bluster, the kind of shell game Trump played in his first term to divert the public attention from what he was really up to. He talks about invading Greenland and Panama to distract you and the media from the theft that's about to happen right under your eyes, the giant tax cut for his billionaire and corporate friends, paid for by massive cuts to Medicare and Medicaid, as Democratic Senator Chris Murphy put it. And as my colleague Molly Jong Fast recently noted, it's important that we not get so wrapped up in the crazy things Trump is saying that we lose sight of what he's actually doing. But Trump's international bullying and his top advisor Elon Musk seeking to use his growing political influence in Britain, Germany, and beyond also shouldn't be brushed off. Sure, the notion of acquiring Greenland, which he proposed buying in his first term, sounds ridiculous. But then again, these are unprecedented times. Is the idea of a freshly emboldened demagogue with imperial designs really that outside the bounds of possibility? Trump is an inveterate shit talker. He may puff his chest out in an effort to get countries to bend to his demands on trade and other policies, but he almost assuredly will not invade Canada. The thing with Trump, though, is this. He almost never does exactly what he says he'll do because it's impossible or impractical or because it butts up against the ambitions of someone else in his orbit or because he didn't completely mean it in the first place. But he also doesn't make completely empty promises. When he wants to do something, he quite often at least attempts it and too frequently manages to get some version of it in motion. He never fully realized the grand border plans he pledged in his first term, for instance, but the inhumanity of the policies he was able to put into effect was exacerbated by their improvised execution. Enacting immigration policy is, of course, different from seizing Greenland, but shit talk takes on a kind of real-world momentum when it comes from a man who will soon occupy the highest office in America. Democratic Senator John Fetterman, speaking on Fox News, seemed open to the idea, saying that he would not support by taking Greenland by force, but that annexing the territory was a responsible conversation to have. If anyone thinks that's bonkers, it's like, well, remember the Louisiana Purchase? Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen and Greenland Prime Minister Mette Egede have both said that the territory is not for sale, though, and don't seem to regard Trump's threat of using force, be it military or economic, as idle. The things that have come out, I think, are some serious statements, Egede said on Tuesday. Those statements may be part of a Nixonian madman approach to foreign policy, which prizes unpredictably as an asset. But when the man in question is Trump, who lives in a right-wing echo chamber where trolling is indistinguishable from sincere endorsement, it is especially hard to see where the strategy ends and the madness begins. Our next headline, I did nothing wrong. Inside Donald Trump's hush money sentencing. This is by Dan Adler on January 10th. Nearly two decades ago, Donald Trump and Stormy Daniels met at a celebrity golf tournament. According to Daniels, it was a tryst in his hotel room that night that set off the first criminal trial of a former president, let alone a future one. Trump has denied sleeping with the adult film star, but the events of their encounter reverberated up until the conclusion of his third presidential campaign last year. In the spring, as he waged his effort to regain the White House, Trump was convicted on 34 counts of falsifying business records in order to cover up a hush money payment to Daniels. On Friday, 10 days before his second inauguration, the president-elect appeared again at the Manhattan courtroom where he stood trial, this time over video call. His appearance culminated a protracted period of legal wrangling to undo his conviction, or at least prevent it from being formalized in a sentencing. On Thursday night, the Supreme Court narrowly denied him a further stay, forcing Trump back into court to receive his punishment. He appeared virtually from Florida alongside his attorney, Todd Blanche, with a pair of American flags serving as a backdrop. Blanche is slated to become the Department of Justice's second highest-ranking official under his client's administration. The judge in the case, Justice Juan Merchan, had already indicated that under the extraordinary circumstances of Trump's imminent return to the presidency, he would not be imposing a prison sentence. Instead, he proposed an unconditional discharge under which Trump would not pay a fine or serve time, but remain a convicted felon. The hearing lasted about 30 minutes, and with the prosecution also recommending an unconditional discharge, had the primary players in the room largely on the same page. As Manhattan prosecutor Joshua Steinglass spoke, Trump shook his head a bit, but he mostly looked bored, as he did throughout the trial. Trump purposely bred disdain for our judicial institutions and the rule of law, Steinglass said, taking a final opportunity to weigh in on the stakes at hand, even as the president-elect would walk free. He's done this to serve his own ends. In response, Blanche took aim at the case itself. What the government just said presupposes something that we disagree with, he said, echoing Trump's attack line throughout the trial and on the campaign trail. This was an appropriate case to be brought. He claimed that it was not just he, Trump, and a go-to coterie of legal experts that agreed on this point. The majority of the American people also agreed that this case should not have been brought, Blanche said. During the spring trial proceedings, Trump stalked into the room every morning, composing his face into a defiant stare as press photographers took his daily portrait. In the instance, his presence was so fleeting as to feel perfunctory, but it did not feature a short speech. The talking points were similarly familiar, with repeated gestures toward the opinions of legal commentators whom he viewed as favorable, and a healthy sprinkling of the phrase, "from what I've heard." "I did nothing wrong," Trump said, concluding his typically meandering remarks. "I'd just like to explain that I was treated very, very unfairly, and I thank you very much." Merchant's turn to speak at the end of the hearing seemed to hold the most potential for narrative deviation. The court allowed media organizations to record audio of the proceedings, a first for this trial, prompting some speculation among reporters that the judge, measured and fluid even by the standards of his profession, might speak more candidly about a defendant who has made sport of attacking him on social media and on the campaign trail. But in the end, the justice seemed to acknowledge how the long tail of the affair had ultimately been subsumed by Trump's decisive re-election. He explained to the defendant why the demands of the presidency meant that he would issue an unconditional discharge, and he offered a parting thought. "Sir, I wish you Godspeed as you assume a second term in office." It still looks like Bess Levin is off, but Casey Wickman has kind of taken her place. This headline, well, it looks like a Mark Zuckerberg's wardrobe and morals both got a little MAGA rebrand. This is published on January 8th. First, Mark Zuckerberg dropped the from Facebook. It's cleaner. And we said nothing. Partly because he was a college student and most of the world didn't know about the social networking startup. Then he ditched the signature dark gray Brunello Cucinelli t-shirt he'd adopted as a daily uniform, an update on his earlier go-to of zip-up hoodies and flip-flops, and started wearing chains and posting shirtless UFC thirst traps, and we said nothing. Now, Zuckerberg has pledged $1 million from Meta to Donald Trump's inauguration fund and announced that Facebook is going to ditch its fact-checking program and rely on community members to police one another, a tech that, wow, has really not worked out well in the past. It's long past time to say something. Zuckerberg's transformation, both inner and outer, appears to be complete. Tech schlub be gone, Mark's a MAGA guy now. What happened to the guy who, at a Facebook town hall event in 2014, explained that he wore the same thing every day because, "I really want to clear my life to make it so that I have to make as few decisions as possible about anything except how to best serve this community"? He said that small decisions like choosing an outfit, for example, kind of make you tired and consume your energy. And my view is, I'm in this really lucky position where I get to wake up every day and help serve more than a billion people. I feel like I'm not doing my job if I spend any of my energy on things that are silly or frivolous about my life. Things can change in a decade, sure, but there does appear to be more than a shred of truth that the yassification of Mark Zuckerberg, including designing a t-shirt collab that likens himself to his own number one favorite boy, Julius Caesar, and wearing a $900,000 watch to announce abandoning any sort of commitment to, you know, the truth, has corresponded with him finding it in himself to care a little more about the so-called silly and frivolous, and much less about that community he so badly wanted to serve. Yes, Zuck has grown out his Caesar of the Valley haircut and gotten a little bit of color to his face, but his glow-up has been paired with attempts to seize yet more personal power and fashion himself into a sort of tech emperor, including making moves to get into the good graces of the powerful ally like Trump, bound for the White House in just a few weeks. Now feels like a good time to remember that just a few months ago, Trump wrote in his latest coffee table book, they can't all be tweets, folks, that Zuckerberg had been plotting against him and that he nurtured a fond little dream of making the founder spend the rest of his life in prison. Zuckerberg, in response, gave him a cool mill. You know, what's really cool? A private demo of his neato AR glasses over dinner at Mar-a-Lago and announced major changes to a Facebook policy that had been implemented in large part after it was found that false information shared on the platform, as well as a lax ad policy, played a significant role in Trump being elected to his first spin round the White House. Oh, and that community Zuck once prized? In the name of restoring free expression on our platforms, as he characterized the policy changes, hate speech restrictions will also be relaxed. Women can be referred to as property, gay people as mentally ill, transgender people as it, and more. You're welcome, valued community. The announcement of the changes harkens the dawn of a community notes model to contextualize information, similar to what Zuckerberg's buddy Elon Musk has implemented on X. You remember X, the social media platform so friendly and non-toxic that users are abandoning it in droves for blue sky and crossing their fingers that that one doesn't explode too? Yes, it's going great over there at X, really something to aspire to. Musk is a certified Trump bestie these days, with a task force and a Floridian guest room all of his own. In Zuckerberg's Mar-a-Lago monogrammed pillow, dreams. Remember when Zuckerberg and Musk were going to have a cage match? It was all cage match this and cage match that, and yet no cage match. Only tweets and more nipple than anyone asked for. I don't want to say what I'm disappointed about, but isn't the world just so disappointing sometimes? It's not all burnt offerings at the altar of Trump and building Pinterest boards for new and exciting chain inspiration. Nope, he's still doing the tech stuff too, you know? His latest breakthrough? Integrating Shazam, an app that does with a standalone program and several steps what any iPhone's default menu can do with one touch and tell you what the hell song is playing into his Ray-Ban Meta AR glasses. You know, so you can look cool while going, ooh, I thought that sounded like Dua Lipa. Free speech is a thing again now, thanks to Facebook, so you're allowed to say that. And Zuckerberg is a fashion guy now, too. Peep those giant lapels, lapellus gigante in the original Latin. So yeah, this should definitely take priority over teaching Aunt Joan that pasting a paragraph onto her newsfeed about how she is above the law does not in fact make her above the law. Anyway, on to what's really important here. What do we think Zuck is going to wear to Trump's inauguration? Bet it'll be cute. Here's another article published on January 8th by Andrew Carell. The headline is, Trump allegedly did a town hall that was quote-unquote rigged in his favor. If you need more confirmation that most of President-elect Donald Trump's complaints about the media are psychological projections, look no further than a forthcoming book reporting that he was fed questions from a Fox News insider ahead of the network's Iowa town hall last January. Then-candidate Trump sat down with Fox anchors Bret Baier and Martha McCallum in front of a studio audience in Des Moines just days ahead of the state's Republican primary vote. Some of Trump's advisors did not want him to participate in the event. Politico's Alex Eisenstadt reports in Revenge, the inside story of Trump's return to power, according to excerpts published Wednesday by CNN. Some of these aides believed the conservative cable giant to be too antagonistic and feared their candidate would not seriously prep for interrogative questions. About 30 minutes before the town hall was due to start, however, Eisenstadt writes, a senior aide started getting text messages from a person on the inside at Fox. Holy shit, the team thought. They were images of all the questions Trump would be asked and the planned follow-ups, down to the exact wording. Jackpot. This was like a student getting a peek at the test before the exam started. Fox News told CNN that while we do not have any evidence of this occurring, and Alex Eisenstadt has conveniently refused to release the images for fact-checking, we take these matters very seriously and plan to investigate, should there prove to be a breach within the network. A Fox source familiar with the matter related to Vanity Fair that if there was a breach, it was not from Bret or Martha or the top editorial levels of the network, and there is a sophisticated and extensive digital footprint of all editorial material. According to Eisenstadt, Baier and McCallum, no slouches when it comes to grilling Trump, intended to press the then-candidate about his business dealings and whether he would disavow political violence and whether he'd be focused on retribution in a second term. Trump was pissed, Eisenstadt writes in the excerpt previewed by CNN, and felt such questions constituted attacks. Nevertheless, with the questions in hand ahead of the live TV event, Trump's team workshopped answers, the reporter notes. If Trump did indeed receive questions in advance, it would be especially rich considering his long history of strategically alleging that pretty much debate or town hall moderator has been biased against him and that such events are rigged for his opponents. After the president-elect's unanimously panned ABC debate, news debate performance against Kamala Harris, Trump repeatedly targeted moderators David Muir and Lindsay Davis, calling them lowlives who deserve to be fired for fact-checking him in real time. He's consistently worked the refs like that since the bygone days of his 2016 campaign. Trump infamously blasted Megyn Kelly, then a Fox News anchor, as a bimbo, with blood coming out of her wherever, following her tough questions during a major GOP primary debate. After his first debate against Hillary Clinton, Trump initially praised NBC News moderator Lester Holt for a great job, only to change his tune once polling suggested he'd lost the debate. "He gave me very unfair questions," the eventual president complained. In 2020, Trump called ABC's Martha Raddatz extraordinarily unfair, and once again complained about a Fox News moderator, this time Chris Wallace, who he labeled a total joke. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thanks for tuning in. Come back next week for another full hour of stories from Vanity Fair. Thank you for listening, and have a great week, everybody.